KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump celebrated his first 100 days in Michigan. He was in a county that voted for him, and that's also affected by his tariffs. We hear from the county executive in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Republicans in Congress want to alter the way students pay for college. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Several proposals would make student loan programs less generous. One goal is to find savings to offset tax cuts. Also, we hear from Ho Chi Minh City, the city once known as Saigon, 50 years after the Vietnam War. It's Wednesday, April 30th. This day in 1789, George Washington gave his inaugural address. He told members of Congress that the new government was an experiment entrusted to the hands of the American people. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A sometime advisor to President Trump, who served in Trump's first term, wants Republicans to raise taxes on the wealthy. Steve Bannon spoke in an interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
Steve Bannon was once Trump's White House strategist and is now a hard-right podcaster who wants to reorient Republicans. He's pressing Congress to cut taxes on lower-income people while not extending tax cuts for the wealthiest.
I don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. I'm not some guy who says tax the rich. I'm saying right now, the math simply doesn't work.
You're worried about the debt.
I'm worried about the debt. You can't have $2 trillion a year in deficits that you have to finance and finance. Now it's killing the working class and middle class.
Trump has toyed with the idea of higher taxes, but also said it might hurt him politically, a remark that Bannon says he takes to mean Trump wants an unconstitutional third term. Steve Inskeep, NPR News.
President Trump is seeking to fire three of the five members of the board of directors for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB provides funding for public media outlets. The CPB has sued Trump in return. The lawsuit says the president does not have the power to fire the board members, according to federal law and a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. The CEO of PBS, Paula Kerger, says the CPB board members are nominated by presidents and confirmed by the Senate.
This is not a government agency. This is a nonprofit organization that was set up to receive the federal appropriation and then distribute it out to the stations. Their job principally is to make sure that the stations are well run and that they are worthy recipients of funding.
She was interviewed by Axios News. PBS and its member stations rely on federal funds from CPB for 15% of their revenues. For NPR member stations, it's 10% on average. NPR itself receives just 1% directly and slightly more indirectly in fees paid by NPR member stations. Federal court hearings are underway to determine a punishment for big tech company Google. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports there is a renewed focus on Google's role in artificial intelligence.
Back in 2020, the government's antitrust case against Google had few mentions of artificial intelligence or AI chatbots. That case was over claims Google monopolized the search engine market. And last August, a federal judge ruled that Google had been acting as a monopoly in that space. Now, the Justice Department says the company could use its artificial intelligence products to strengthen its monopoly in online search, and then use the data from its powerful search index to become the dominant player in AI. Google denies this, saying the AI marketplace is full of healthy competition with OpenAI's ChatGPT and Meta AI. So, Google and the DOJ are in court again. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Google is a financial supporter of NPR. You're listening to NPR. A federal judge has released Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi. The legal permanent resident of the U.S. had been detained by the Trump administration in Vermont for weeks. The administration is trying to deport him. Mahdawi's lawyers say the administration targeted him for his political activism. Stocks on Wall Street are falling this morning. That comes as the Commerce Department says the nation's gross domestic product shrank at an annual rate of 0.3%. During the first quarter of this year. That shrinking number was affected by a surge of imports. Consumers are racing to buy things before President Trump's tariffs took effect. Package delivery company UPS says it is planning to eliminate up to 20,000 jobs and close more than 70 facilities. UPS is citing tariffs and sharp cuts in the volume of shipments from its largest customer, Amazon. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Marlon Hyde has more.
UPS plans to reduce its workforce as it continues to cut the number of Amazon shipments handled in half by June of next year. Here's CEO Carol Tomei.
The environment may be uncertain, but with our actions, we will emerge as an even stronger, more nimble UPS.
Tomei says business owners are weighing their shipping options as tariffs persist. Last year, U.S.-China trade lanes made up 11% of the company's international revenue. In a statement, the Teamsters Union threatened to retaliate if UPS violates their contract by eliminating Teamster jobs and say the company is obligated to create 30,000 union jobs. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faudel. Coming up, we learn about the owls that come in for a landing at Boston's Logan Airport.
Who is going to do that story? Anyway, today marks 100 days since President Trump took office, and last night he celebrated with a rally in Michigan.
We've accomplished more in 3 months than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or even 8 years, and we're just getting started. Believe me, we're just getting started.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has this look at what has changed since Trump's first term.
When Trump came into office in 2017, it was a shock to the political system. But his first term looks downright tame compared to 100 days of Trump 2.0. And a lot of that has to do with Trump putting his stamp, or rather his large Sharpie signature, on the government and the nation's institutions with incredible speed and intensity. It started on Inauguration Day, as Staff Secretary Will Scharf presented him with one executive action after another.
The first item that President Trump is signing is the rescission of 78 Biden-era executive actions, executive orders, presidential memoranda, and others.
And he did it all in a sports arena packed with cheering supporters.
Could you imagine Biden doing this? I don't think so.
These signings have become a near daily occurrence in Trump's White House, and they've led to far more dramatic and immediate action than the first time around, reshaping the government and seeking retribution against his political enemies. Trump even changed the name of the body of water that borders America's southern states.
You know, we're flying over right now. We're flying over a thing called the Gulf of America.
Just like his first term, Trump is dominating the national conversation. But this time, he's meeting with less resistance.
By the way, he's enjoying the hell out of himself at this point, too.
David Urban is a longtime Trump ally.
The president is much more confident in his own abilities, in his understanding of what needs to be done and how to pull the levers and make things happen.
Doug Sosnick was a senior advisor in the Clinton White House, and he says he expected Trump would transform Washington in a way that he didn't in his first term.
Now, having said that, never in my wildest dreams did I think for a moment that Trump would come in and do what he's done.
He says Trump's public fights with allies have upended America's relationship with the world. The president took his tariff ambitions much further and much faster this time around, sending consumer confidence into a tailspin. Trump is also pushing the limits of presidential power, a fight now playing out in the courts. But Sosnick says there is a risk in Trump's aggressive approach to the presidency this time around.
Just doing a lot of stuff doesn't necessarily make you successful.
During Trump 1.0, he faced pushback from within his own administration. The second Trump administration is all loyalists. Gone are the establishment Republicans who saw themselves as guardrails working behind the scenes to temper his plans. Congress is more compliant as well. Back in 2017, there were Republicans like Arizona Senator Jeff Flake who openly questioned what Trump was doing in this Washington Post video.
I think the Republican Party is in a crisis.
But Flake and Republicans like him aren't in Congress anymore. The Republican majorities in the House and Senate are far more willing to go along with Trump's demands. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is a rare Republican still willing to oppose Trump, but only sometimes.
We are all afraid.
At an event earlier this month in Alaska, she said she was anxious about speaking up.
Because retaliation is real.
Trump's approval rating at 100 days has fallen to the lowest of any president in 80 years. And in the sprint to do everything all at once, there have been mistakes. Tariffs on an island inhabited only by penguins, firing critical employees only to have to beg them to come back. Top national security officials talking about military attack plans on a group chat that a prominent journalist had been added to by mistake. Billionaire Elon Musk, charged with cutting the federal bureaucracy, conceded there would be mistakes.
Some of the things that I say will be incorrect and should be corrected. So nobody's going to bat 1,000.
But unlike in Trump 1.0, so far at least, no heads have rolled in the upper ranks of the administration. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Macomb County, Michigan, where the president spoke last night, is a classic swing county. It voted twice for Barack Obama and then three times for Donald Trump. But while voting for Trump, the county also voted for Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer and for Mark Hackle, who is the Democratic County Executive and our next guest. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
What is Macomb County like for those who haven't been? I'm looking at the map. You're outside Detroit.
Yeah, we're outside Detroit. I mean, obviously, we border Lake St. Clair, just north of the city of Detroit. And, about a million people, just closing in on a million people as far as population, heavily automotive. We're very strong on defense. And, you know, we've got about 1,600 manufacturers. You know, they employ about 70,000 individuals. So, you know, it's a strong workforce that we have here. And, you know, just kind of one of those communities that, you know, when it comes to our politics, as you just got through mentioning, you know, they kind of differ. You know, sometimes they'll favor the Democratic side, the Republican side. And, you know, it's swung over more to the conservative side as of the past probably 10 years than we've ever seen before.
So classic blue collar county. And you mentioned another thing that's very interesting. It's common for us to say we don't make anything anymore in America. People actually make things in Macomb County, Michigan. Residents in Macomb County make things.
Yeah, about 10 years ago when manufacturing was a challenge, we doubled down on it. And I think we're manufacturing more things as a result.
How do the president's early actions match with people's expectations in your county that voted for him?
Yeah, I think a lot of anxiety, you know, across the board, whether it's in education departments, people that provide, you know, some assistance to others, you know, the issues dealing with DEI. You know, there's a lot of concerns with our manufacturers, automotive, even in defense. And so, you know, some of those policies, I think, had a lot of people up in arms and, you know, concerned. And I think it was not weighing in his favor during that time.
What do the automotive tariffs specifically mean for people in Macomb County?
Interesting enough, we've talked to a lot of our manufacturers and even some of the big three. We're having more conversation with them. We're constantly conversing with them to find out what this means. I think they're trying to make a determination, you know, what is real, what is not. You know, sometimes he says something, he's negotiating with himself. So many of them are taking a measured approach here in Macomb County, kind of the wait and see what's happening, but also trying to make some of those adjustments in case they, you know, what he says is the direction he's going in, which makes them very concerned.
Are people feeling paralyzed then?
You know, I don't know if it's paralyzed. They're still trying to figure out how do they manage what they're doing, trying to provide, the connections that they can, and making sure that they're, sourcing things the way they need to source them, trying to make sure they're providing the outputs of the products. They're still trying to do what they normally have done, but I think the big concern is, what is the cost associated with it and how they pass it along to a customer.
Yeah, I guess we should just remind people the auto industry has set itself up in such a way that products move across the border from Canada and from Mexico to the United States back and forth as cars are assembled. The components come from lots of places. The assembly is done a lot of places. That's really complicated. It's hard to mess with. But when I talk with people in the Midwest, where I'm from, sometimes I hear people say, okay, fine, this is all complicated, but too many manufacturing jobs have gone away. We need a reset. We need something drastic. Do you hear people in your county saying, I don't know what the solution is, but we needed to do something drastic?
Yeah, that's definitely part of the conversation. Even the United Auto Workers, they're pretty much, they're applauding the tariffs, and which was kind of surprising. We weren't sure exactly, what that meant. But, Sean Fain was out there, crediting the president for doing that. So
he's been on this program talking about it, yeah.
Yeah, and he actually lives in Macomb County, as a matter of fact. So, that being said, you're trying to figure out, okay, what does this really mean? You've got, which you usually would think there'd be opposition on behalf of the auto workers supporting, the president's ideas of bringing these companies, these jobs back to the United States, and in particular the state of Michigan.
I've just got about 15 seconds, but we had an economist on the program today talking about a recession drawing closer. Are you preparing for economic hard times?
Yeah, we've heard about that. We've talked to economists, and they tend to think that if there is a recession, Macomb County is going to do pretty well through that process, but it's definitely going to be something that's concerning to us.
Mark Hackel is the Democratic County Executive in Macomb County, Michigan, where President Trump spoke last night. Thanks so much, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
The snowbirds are heading north again, and no, this is not about the Canadians who winter in Florida. Snowy owls fly south from the Arctic to spend the winter at a Boston airport.
Logan Airport is an area that is 1,800 acres of short-mowed grass that looks very much like the Arctic tundra.
Norman Smith studies birds like the snowy owl that catch prey.
They actually eat a lot of ducks and rodents that are on the airfield. So there's plenty of food, and it probably looks more like home to them than any place else around.
Smith started volunteering with the organization Mass Audubon in 1966, and today he conducts research on raptors for the organization.
And he's become an expert on the Logan Airport owls. Smith says that before he got involved, the airport had a very different way of dealing with the birds.
The FAA made it mandatory that airports have to create a bird patrol, which keeps airports bird-free, or as bird-free as they can. And the goal and objective back then was to shoot birds that were on the airport, because obviously you don't want a bird to get caught in an engine of a plane.
In 1981, Smith wrote a letter to the airport asking if he could take a different approach, a more humane approach.
Well, I started going out there and studying the snowy owls and then trapping them and removing them from the airport for the safety of the owl and for the safety of the aircraft there as well. And I've relocated over 900 snowy owls so far from Logan Airport.
Amazing. The birds are usually released far away from the airfield in Cape Cod or the North Shore. Smith is the only owl catcher at Logan Airport, although other airports are following his lead.
We wrote a protocol which was adopted by the USDA, and that protocol was to live trap and remove birds, which was accepted at most of the airports, throughout the United States now and Canada.
And right now is about the time of year when the snowy owls start to fly back to the Arctic. They usually return in the fall, and Smith plans to greet them at the airport again when they do. This is NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
A once fringe movement to increase birth rates is exploding into the mainstream, but it's not just about having more babies. On the next Fresh Air, we'll explore the politics of pronatalism, from Elon Musk's crusade against population collapse to ideas about genetic engineering and the so-called Great Replacement. We'll speak to NPR's Lisa Hagen and demographer Karen Guzzo. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Yesterday, you heard on this program from an imprisoned Columbia University student detained over his advocacy for Palestinian rights in the midst of the Gaza war. The government is accusing Mohsen Mahdawi, a Vermont resident, of stoking anti-Semitism, something he and his lawyers deny. In a Vermont prison, he told me this.
When I signed on the Pledge of Allegiance, I signed to protect and defend the Constitution, and I am practicing here my constitutional rights, not to call for any destruction of anyone, not to fight anyone. I'm saying we need peace, we need to stop the war, and we want children, all children, to live in peace, without fear and without trauma.
Today, Mahdawi is free. A federal judge in Vermont hearing his petition accusing government officials of violating his First Amendment right to free speech and his right to due process ordered him released as this case continues. Joining me now to talk about this is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. He's been following this case. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we just heard what Mahdawi said in prison. Now he's released, still in at risk of being deported. What did the judge rule, and did we hear from him as a free man?
Yeah, so U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Crawford said Mahdawi's detention for 2 weeks, quote, so far demonstrate great harm to a person who has been charged with no crime. So he ordered his immediate release. Mahdawi came out of the federal court in Vermont. You know, he did the peace signs with his fingers and was received by supporters that were cheering on him. Here's what he said after his release.
It sends a message that is loud and clear, not only to the Vermonters, but to the rest of America. And the message is, we the people will hold the Constitution accountable for the principles and values that we believe in.
Now, as you point out, there he was charged with no crime, but the government is trying to deport him. What are the conditions of his release?
So he must stay in his home state of Vermont and attend college virtually, although he is allowed to travel to New York City for his schooling and meetings with his attorneys.
Now, he's the first student of multiple that have been detained by the Trump administration, seemingly over their advocacy for Palestinian rights in the midst of the Gaza war under a rarely used Immigration Act. What are Mahdawi's lawyers saying about this case and what it
means? His lawyers today came out and said it was a good day. They said that, you know, they got a relief for now. They again say that the accusations that their client, that Mahdawi, you know, has participated in activity that is illegal is not true. And they also say, you know, that again, they're relief for now, but they acknowledge, Leila, that there's a long road ahead. They'll be back in court and they will ask the court for a fully protection from deportation. But for now, they're celebrating.
So this is in the federal court over his constitutional rights. There's also immigration proceedings going on in the immigration court. Any comment from the federal government on this?
Not yet, but it's important to note that the administration, again, has accused Mahdawi's actions, particularly his involvement in protests, as you know, they're saying that they're undermining its efforts to combat anti-Semitism. Again, we haven't heard from them right now, but I think it's fair to assume that they're going to come back and try to appeal this decision. Mahdawi, though, had this to say to the administration today.
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
to President Trump and his cabinet. Yes. I'm not afraid of you.
That's NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you.
You're welcome.
House Republicans are sharing details of their plan to make big changes to the federal student loan system and cut spending along the way. Their plans affect repayment options and Pell Grants and also offers a new way to hold colleges accountable. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner is lending us some of his time to talk about this. Corey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What are the proposals, which we should clarify are not yet law?
Yeah, well, it's hard to overstate just how much Republicans want to do here. They want to eliminate PLUS loans for graduate students. They also want to cap parent PLUS loans for parents who are going to help their kids pay for college.
Okay.
And then they want to eliminate subsidized loans for undergraduate students. This is a big one. That means, Steve, in the future, if you take out a loan to go to college, the government would no longer cover the interest while you're in school.
Oh, big change. Okay.
Yeah. And then there are changes to the rules for Pell Grants, which are for low-income students, don't need to be paid back. Republicans want to expand the program to give students access to use Pell to cover short-term workforce training, but they also want to make it harder to qualify for a full Pell award by increasing the number of credit hours a student has to take each year. And then there's one more big change here when it comes to the aid students get, and that is a seismic shift in borrowers' repayment options. Republicans want to simplify things down to really two basic repayment plans. There's a standard plan with a fixed monthly payment, looks a lot like the old. But then there is what they're calling a repayment assistance plan that bases monthly payments on a borrower's income. But unlike the old income plans that offered forgiveness after 20 or 25 years, this new one could last for 30.
Oh, that's interesting. So every one of these details doesn't matter much if you don't have a student loan, but could affect your payments if you're going into college, if you're thinking about this, if you have experience with student loans. And what is the change on the university side, the colleges that get paid?
Yeah, there's a really big idea here Republicans are putting out. They're proposing what they're calling skin in the game accountability for colleges. Basically, if colleges and universities want access to the federal student loan program, which, trust me, Steve, they do, they're going to have to agree to reimburse the government for a share of the debt when their students don't repay their loans. Hmm. While Republicans are pushing this new way to hold schools accountable, though, they are also planning to end some pretty important past protections for students, especially for borrowers who attend schools that close suddenly and for borrowers who say they were defrauded by their schools.
What's the goal of all this? This is NPR News.
Weeks ahead of extreme weather season in the U.S., the Trump administration canceled billions in weather disaster funding. The shift from federal to local leaves more people in small towns in harm's way.
Guys, this is dangerous. Our sewer plant is going to continue to overflow.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, staying safe with less federal support on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Gross domestic product has fallen for the first time in 3 years. The government reporting the U.S. economy shrank at an annual pace of 0.3% in the first quarter. Imports surged ahead of President Trump's tariffs. The night before the GDP report came out, the president at a rally in Michigan touted his performance in his first 100 days back in office As NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
He has a lot more experience. As a longtime Trump ally told me, he has been through the knife fights and knows how to use the levers of power. Mm-hmm. And he's having an easier time of it so far as well. During Trump 1.0, he faced pushback from within his own administration. The second Trump administration is all loyalists. Gone are the establishment Republicans who saw themselves as guardrails working behind the scenes to temper his plans.
NPR's Elena Moore reports congressional Republicans are working on passing Trump's massive legislative agenda.
One is over the future of Medicaid, mm-hmm. the government insurance program available for low-income Americans and folks with disabilities. It falls under the House Energy and Commerce Committee's control, and the committee is looking to propose $880 billion in cuts. Mm. And Democrats point to a recent analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office to conclude that cuts to Medicaid would have to happen in order to get to that number. Still, you know, some Republicans have come out strongly against this.
It's NPR News. Election results show Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's Liberal Party has fallen short of a clear majority in Parliament. The Liberals will need help from another party to pass legislation. On Monday, a majority of voters opted to keep Carney in power, the outcome widely seen as a response to President Trump's tariff and sovereignty threats against Canada. Germany's center-left Social Democrats have approved a deal to join a new coalition government there, paving the way for Parliament to elect Conservative leader Friedrich Merz as the country's new chancellor. And NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
The party of outgoing Chancellor Olaf Scholz will join a coalition led by Merz's center-right Christian Democratic Union and its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, which won Germany's February election with more than 28% of the vote. The Social Democrats suffered their worst result since World War II, finishing third with just 16.4% of the vote. But the Conservatives need their support to assemble a parliamentary majority without the far-right anti-immigration Alternative for Germany party, which finished in second place. Merz is scheduled to be sworn in as Germany's newest chancellor next week. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
U.S. stocks trading lower this hour. The Dow's down 258 points, roughly 0.5%. The S&P is down nearly 1%. The Nasdaq is down 1.3%. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. People in Vietnam are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War today in Ho Chi Minh City, formerly known as Saigon. On April 30th, 1975, the North Vietnamese Army entered the city and took control of South Vietnam after almost 20 years of war and about 2 years after American troops left. Joining us to talk about the ceremony marking this 50th anniversary is journalist Na Pham in Ho Chi Minh City. Hi.
Hello. Good morning, Leila.
So tell us about the ceremony and who attended.
Well, thousands of people gathered on the streets in Ho Chi Minh City early this morning. The ceremony started with a speech by the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Tô Lâm. He called for national unity and support for the Communist Party's economic policies. And it was attended by top leaders and international guests, including the president of Laos and the top leader of Cambodia, Hun Sen. But the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam was not on the podium, and this led to some disappointment amongst the Vietnamese. Because the U.S. and Vietnam have become close partners in recent years, and people do expect foreign friends to join these celebrations.
So you said diplomats from the U.S. weren't there. Why not?
Well, the U.S. ambassador was not there because it was reported that the Trump administration told U.S. diplomats in Vietnam not to attend any event in Ho Chi Minh City and Hanoi. But at the last minute, I think the restriction was eased. So the consul general in Ho Chi Minh City, Susan Burns, was actually present at the parade today.
What do Vietnamese people today think about marking this 50th anniversary?
Well, it's a big public holiday here. So walking around Ho Chi Minh City, you could actually feel the excitement of a street party. And people were wearing red, the national color of Vietnam, of course, waving the flag and playing patriotic songs. It was almost like carnival. I spoke to a local resident, Phuong Nghiêm.
I came here at 4 a.m. in the morning. It's a grand ceremony for the whole country. The entire country united together. So I would like to see the marching, the helicopter. It's awesome.
It's also a very successful PR campaign by the government here to try to reignite a sense of deep respect for the military felt by previous generations, especially during wartime.
So it sounds like marking this anniversary has brought up a lot of national pride.
That's right. You can really tell that people here are very proud of the country's past struggles. They went against the French, the Americans, and the Chinese. But also they are equally proud of what they have achieved so far, 50 years after the war. So I spoke to veteran American journalist Jim Laurie, who actually covered the Vietnam War for NBC and witnessed the fall of Saigon.
There's no real sense of history in what's going on today. It's a grand celebration, but I see in the Vietnamese a tremendous pride, and it's a celebration of what they've become, not what they were.
Well, the people are very proud, but of course Vietnam is facing a lot of serious challenges, especially in developing their economy. There's an enormous task for the ruling Communist Party. They will have to improve people's standard of living in order to maintain legitimacy. And people are really worried about trade because most of the country's income comes from exports.
Na Pham joining us from Ho Chi Minh City. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's hear a reporter who covered the Vietnam War, Lauren Jenkins, who had never expected to be there.
I didn't want to be a war correspondent. I thought I'd be a film critic, but... but the big stories of my generation were wars.
In later years, Lauren Jenkins was NPR's foreign editor, a white-bearded Ernest Hemingway sort of figure here at NPR. But in April 1975, he was in Saigon reporting for Newsweek.
The North was beginning to fold up what little South Vietnamese resistance there was, and moving south was a big crowd of refugees trying to flee the North. It was just slowly unrolling. We knew it was going to end in Saigon. There was nothing to stop them. The embassy had evacuation plans. They were going to broadcast "I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas" on the military radio system as a code to evacuate.
Huh.
Some of us in the press, I mean, we were told to go out to the airport and jump on a plane and get out of there. Some of us thought that was sort of stupid, that as long as it was an American embassy, we were going to see that fold up.
I'm just trying to imagine the American embassy in Saigon. I guess there's a compound, there's some grounds.
Big wall, six-story building, flat roof. When I got in through the main gate, that was guarded by Marines and hundreds of Vietnamese trying to get in, hoping to be evacuated because they were compromised for having worked with the Americans. The Americans preparing to, you know, get rid of all their security files. There were stuff streaming out of the embassy windows, ticker tape, shredded documents. couple of security guards came down with a load of dollars to burn in the incinerator that clearly had come from the CIA main office.
Didn't want the $100 bills to fall in enemy hands.
Yeah, because there was a lot of smoke coming out of a lot of windows as they were burning documents. By then, they had been helicoptering people off the roof. There were Vietnamese generals, the Saigon fire chief, and, you know, Vietnamese that had worked for Americans who wanted to leave before they were sent off to re-education camps.
Yeah.
The ambassador lowered the flag around 4 a.m. in the morning, folded it into a nice triangle, moved up with his secretary and his pet dog to the roof. He got in one helicopter, put the secretary and the dog in another, and they flew off. And then a couple of us journalists that were still there, we flew off in the helicopter after him.
Having covered so many years of the war, and then having seen the very, very end, what thoughts passed through your mind about it all?
Oh, I was just glad it was over. It was a stupid war. It never should have been waged. It was vicious and nasty to everybody, to the Americans who were set to fight it, and to the poor Vietnamese who had us bomb them. I filed my last story and flew to Bali to sit on a beach with Hunter Thompson and look at it, see, and talk about the past.
Do you think Americans learned anything from that bitter experience?
No. The problem is Washington. They're intellectually not aware of what their actions really do. The policymakers rarely go to the places they're making policy about. And I think that's the problem.
Lauren Jenkins, it's a great pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
This is NPR News.
We'll check in with the voters who turned out for President Trump in November. How do they think he's doing after the first 100 days? That's next time, here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. They say news travels fast, so the favorite to win this year's Kentucky Derby should be obvious, a horse named Journalism. The news-making stallion is a 3-1 favorite in the race this Saturday. Won't be easy. Right at his tail are Sovereignty and Sandman with 5-1 and 6-1 odds, and he'll have to deal with competition from Owen Almighty and American Promise. Personally, I support Journalism. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Generations of workers in this country found a path into the middle class through federal government jobs, and that includes a lot of black people in this country. The Trump administration's job cuts are now throwing that sense of stability up in the air. NPR's Hansilo Wong met with one such worker.
Shirley Hopkins built careers for countless other black workers.
This is one of the awards that I got.
And she has the plaques from the federal government to prove it.
I was puffed up.
And it was for promoting equal opportunity.
Before she retired from the National Institutes of Health, she was known as the recruitment lady. She made it her mission to encourage more black students in the Washington, D.C. area to apply for the agency's internship and youth employment programs.
It was equal opportunity for those who really didn't have. You were able to get them a chance to get into the federal government.
Hopkins first got into NIH back in the 1960s as a nurse's aide in clinical trials. The federal job came with benefits her parents didn't have.
Vacation, you're covered. Sick leave, you're covered. And not being fearful like you are now, whether or not you're going to lose your job.
These days, the Trump administration's slashing of government jobs and attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are upending a path into the middle class for many black workers. It began when World War II brought a boom in government jobs.
Black Americans, for the first time, had doors opened to them that really weren't open before.
Frederick Gooding Jr. is a historian at Texas Christian University who wrote a book about black federal workers called American Dream Deferred.
It was very difficult for black Americans to find any type of well-paying job, particularly outside of agricultural or domestic endeavors.
But by the 1940s, Gooding says the federal government's merit system offered opportunities that helped a black middle class grow.
Now, the flip side to this is that a good government job was not necessarily a golden ticket.
The federal civil service has had long-standing racial and ethnic pay gaps. Gooding says he's concerned the push by Trump officials to dismantle DEI programs will leave black federal employees in a very vulnerable position when it comes to workplace discrimination. The White House did not respond to NPR's request for comment.
They say cut back!
We say fight back!
Some federal employees are trying to organize, including at the U.S. Postal Service, where, like at many other federal agencies, black people make up about a third of the workforce, while their share of the country's population is around 15%.
My family is under attack. And we're going to fight like hell to make sure that they get their hands off the Postal Service and hands off the Department of Education.
Kevin Abernathy helped lead this rally outside D.C. He's a nephew of Shirley Hopkins, who pushed him to apply for his first federal job as a teenager. Now he's a union steward with the National Association of Letter Carriers.
Not too bad. I put the day's mail in there.
After more than three decades with USPS, Abernathy delivers on what he calls a retirement route in Maryland.
I love serving the people. Post office has given me everything I have in life, the cars, my home. I raised four kids on this salary.
Until recently, Abernathy's career advice to his kids was consistent.
If they didn't make millions of dollars catching a football or shooting a basketball or whatever, the government is where you want to be.
But his oldest son has decided it's no longer where he wants to be. With the Trump administration pushing to shrink the federal workforce, Abernathy's son left a government job in January to join the private sector. You went into government for stability. Your oldest son left the government for stability.
Yep, different times. Things are changing. We just don't know what the outcome is going to be.
And that means adjusting career advice for his youngest children. He's advising them to look outside the government for now. Hansilo Wong, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The new film April follows an OBGYN who travels through rural Georgia, the country bordering Russia, to provide abortions to women. Women who don't have the means to pay for the procedure and, in many cases, were raped. We're going to talk about the film and about that sexual violence for the next 7 or so minutes. The feature was largely shot in secret at a time of increased abortion restrictions in the country. Director Dea Kolumbagashvili told me she was inspired to make this feature after former classmates cut short their education to get married and have kids as teens.
When we were 15, my classmates started to get married, and it was not something they wanted to do, but it was mostly either like encouraged or arranged marriages or kidnappings, which was also kind of part of how the marriages would be arranged. I was very lucky that my father was very critical of all of this, and he kind of made sure that we would not end up getting married this way. And I guess, like, out of luck, because I was born in the family which prioritized my education and my future, I was able to have a profession.
So is this film about choice, about women and choice?
In a way, it is, because, like, even for the character who's assaulted and who's, like, raped repeatedly in the film, and we understand that she had several abortions already, maybe she would want to keep a child, but she doesn't even have that choice.
And this is one of the women that Nina, the main character, the doctor, is repeatedly giving abortions.
Yes.
The woman's mother asks the doctor to give her abortions.
Yes, if a woman gets pregnant as a result of the rape in rural Georgia, most of the times they can't obtain abortions because nobody really cares about how these women would live with the children, mm-hmm. because it's considered to be a woman's responsibility to take care of a child no matter what. Even if a woman would want to keep this child, she would not be able to do it because it's a shame for the family.
In this part of Georgia, abortions aren't legal?
Officially, abortions are legal, but it's kind of impossible to get an abortion at the end of the day, like, especially outside of a capital and outside of, like, two major or three major cities in Georgia.
So it's not technically illegal, but it's pretty much impossible for young women if they don't go to the big cities.
Yes.
And you embedded in a birthing clinic for this film, right?
Yes. I was able to spend a year there.
A year?
With the doctors, yes.
Wow. I mean, this isn't a documentary. It's a fictional yeah. film. Why was it important to spend that much time in a birthing clinic? And you actually film in graphic detail in this movie both a natural birth and a C-section.
It was really invaluable for me as a filmmaker to stay in a clinic for a year with my lead actress and with also other actors and with a cinematographer. And they showed us, like, what their life really are made of. I did not need to invent anything. I could just see all these people doing something which was so much more important than cinema in a way. And we became part of their process rather than the opposite.
Did you face challenges in Georgia as you made this film and researched this film and shot the film?
Well, yes. I don't even know how to talk about it because film has never been screened in Georgia.
And this film?
Yes. It's been totally kind of hidden and it kind of doesn't exist. And I guess,
why?
Because it does talk about something which government really doesn't want us to talk about in a way, because I guess, like, what's the biggest problem now is that government does encourage, in a way, the violence against women because it goes largely unpunished, or it goes very mildly punished, I would say. And at the moment, I don't see a possibility to engage this dialogue because I don't think there is readiness from authorities to actually talk about this.
Are you disappointed? I mean, this sounds like what you wanted was to start a conversation.
Yes.
About the things that you witnessed and that you saw and that women went through, and now it can't be screened anywhere in Georgia, and this is a film in your native language about where you grew up.
Yes, there was always a choice that I could make this film outside of Georgia, but it was like a very conscious decision for me. I wanted to make it in the place where I grew up.
With the resistance in Georgia to the film,
mm-hmm.
do you think you'll be able to make another film in Georgia anytime soon?
No, because I did make this film largely in secret.
Oh.
And I don't think that I would be able to do it again. And I don't know, like, if I go there and make a film about something which would be not addressing any problems or any issues or how people really live, maybe there would be a possibility, but I don't think I would want to do something like that.
Yeah. It was a hard film to watch, honestly, because it's like you're unsettled when you finish the film for a long time over what's happening to these women. Was that purposeful? I mean, just talk about making the film, because it is very artistic. You have these beautiful shots of the rural countryside of Georgia, but then these really, in some cases, violent, in some cases, implicit or explicit images of birth, of abortion. I mean, just talk about what your goal was with the way that you made it.
I guess, like, it's important for me to show it all, because together with the violence, it's important to understand that there is also all this beauty, and it's part of our life there as well. Like, it's true that this film is hard to watch.
Yeah.
And recently I was thinking that maybe only now I started to get out also from the experience of making it, because it was a difficult experience for me as well.
Really?
Yes, because, like, I would see things which obviously maybe are not directly part of the film, but I was going into the houses to talk to women. I could see them having scars and, like, obvious, like, signs of violence in their lives, and then they don't want to talk about it.
So women who are dealing with domestic abuse of some kind?
Yes.
And what would you say is the goal of the film? I mean, when you think about now, it's out in the world and people are watching it. What do you want them to take away from it?
I think we need to be aware that women's rights are not something which are set in stone and which are, like, forever.
Hmm.
Because we're not even, like, done with basically fighting, because big part of our world is still struggling with very basic and very fundamental rights, which women do not have.
Director Dia Kolumbagashvili, her new film, April, is out in theaters now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I...
a dream.